Okay, so just to recap, we've been discussing the topic of rationalist versus non-rationalist, or as I called it last week, mystical Judaism. And we divide it into three areas: knowledge, nature, and the service of God. Right? And really, the second two, nature and the service of God, are really subsets of knowledge, of the first aspect of epistemology. Okay, so see this over this list here that knowledge. Rationalists believe that knowledge is legitimately obtained by man via his reasoning and senses, and should preferably be based upon evidence, reason, rather than faith, especially for far-fetched claims. As mystics are skeptical of the human ability of the human mind to arrive at truths, and prefer to base knowledge on revelation, or for those who are not worthy of revelation, on faith in those who do experience revelation. We discussed how rationalists believe that, we're capable of figuring things out. That is how knowledge is obtained, by people figuring things out. And that's how knowledge can be obtained and should be obtained. Whereas mystics believe that they're skeptical of all that, and they say that the best way of figuring things out is revelation, and that a lot of people are privy to that. That Chazal got Ruach HaKodesh, the Rishonim got Ruach HaKodesh, the Gedolim, the great scholars of today, get Ruach HaKodesh. I just want to mention something interesting on that idea. There's a principle in the Gemara, a principle of Sod Hashem Li Re'ov. Right? God's secret is for those who fear him. Which is used to mean that the great Torah scholars, right, people who are Yirei Shemayim, great Tzadikim, are given or granted by God certain insights into the natural world. People heard that phrase being used, Sod Hashem Li Re'ov? Yeah, can you just type in yes if you've heard people use that to justify how Chazal would know facts about nature that would not otherwise have been known? Okay. So it's a known principle from the Gemara. So how many times do you think it appears in the Gemara? And how many times does the Gemara suggest that somebody may have known something using the principle of Sod Hashem Li Re'ov? Give a guess. How many times does the Gemara say that one of Chazal knew something via Sod Hashem Li Re'ov? No, not zero. It appears in the Gemara. So I've done an informal survey, and I think most people say maybe half a dozen or a dozen times. In fact, the Gemara only employs that principle on three occasions, and in each of those three occasions, it's only given as a possible explanation of how someone knew something, as well as other more rationalist explanations. So the Gemara only suggests it as a possibility on three occasions, and even then doesn't say it's definitively the case. But what you have more recently is that the Leshem, which is Eliezer's grandfather, he writes that every single thing that Chazal said was via the principle of Sod Hashem Li Re'ov. Everything, no matter what it was. I can put the quote for you. Place it in the window here. Place it up here. Here we go. Here. The main thing is, everyone who is called a Jew is obligated to believe with complete faith that everything found in the words of the sages, whether in Halachas or Agadas of the Talmud or in the Midrashim, are all the words of the living God. For everything which they said is with the Spirit of God which spoke within them, and the secret of God is given to those who fear him. This is just as we find in Sanhedrin 48b, that even regarding something which has no explanation, application to Halacha and practical behavior, the Talmud asks regarding Rav Nachman, how did he know this? The reply given is because he knew it via Sod Hashem Li Re'ov. Right? Now this is something which in the Gemara is only given three times as a possibility, and there's certainly many, many, many cases in the Gemara where it's assumed that the sages did not have any supernatural access to knowledge. There's many times in the Gemara where the sages are said to have gotten things wrong, or they had to ask non-Jews for what they say about things. It's a principle which in the Gemara has incredibly limited application. And I've just I was working on a paper tracking the progress of this concept, and you see that it gradually expands in scope until you get to a situation where, you know, in our generation, recent generations, people were claiming that every single thing Chazal said was via divine inspiration. So you see how the epistemology, the view of how knowledge is obtained, you know, changes over time. And that's an also important point when we're discussing when comparing rationalist versus non-rationalist approaches. What's important to realize is that rationalism has been drastically declining. You know, its highlight was in the times of the Rishonim in Sfarad, in medieval Spain, in, you know, 12th, 13th century and so on. And it's been very much on the decline since then. We'll discuss that a little bit later on, why that happened and so on. Chesky is giving some good examples here. Okay, so that's you know, another example of different approaches to how knowledge is obtained. Okay, then we have the topic of nature. Yeah, the rationalists value a naturalistic rather than supernatural interpretation of events. Again, which relates to the knowledge, it's the idea that we can figure out how things run in the world, and they perceive a consistent natural order over history, past, present, and future. And again, the idea is that, you know, that God should be running the world in ways that we can understand, and that is the ideal way of perceiving God, you know, through an incredible system of laws of nature that we can figure out, as opposed to incomprehensible miracles. Because mystics prefer miracles. And finally, we have the topic of the service of God. The rationalists understand the purpose of mitzvahs and religious life in general as furthering intellectual and moral goals for the individual and society. Because mystics see mitzvahs as performing mechanistic manipulations of spiritual or celestial forces, their reasons being either to accomplish this, right, to accomplish the manipulations of celestial forces, or whether they're ultimately incomprehensible. Or they say, you know, we just can't understand what mitzvahs are really about. Now, last week we started discussing some examples. I think we discussed mezuzah and netilat yadayim. I don't think we discussed shiluach hakein. Is that correct? Mind me? Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about Shiluach HaKein, because I think that Shiluach HaKein is the single greatest example of the radical shift between the rationalist approach of the Rishonim and the non-rationalist approach of today. So what's Shiluach HaKein? Okay, you have this mitzvah, there's actually two components. Right? One component, there's a negative commandment and a positive commandment. Today you come across a bird's nest, and you see, you know, a mother bird and eggs, and you think, you know, this will make a great meal, schnitzel and omelets. And the Torah has two commandments. First is a negative prohibition. You're not allowed to take the mother and young. You're not allowed to take both generations. Here's up here. Here's the verses. If you happen upon a bird's nest along the road, and any tree on the ground, with fledglings or eggs, and the mother is crouching over the fledglings or the eggs, do not take the mother together with the young. That's a negative prohibition. Then you have the positive commandment. Send away the mother and take the young for yourself, in order that they may be good for you and your days shall be lengthened. Right? The positive commandment is that you send away the mother bird, and then you can take the young. Now, what is this mitzvah all about? So, in the times of the Rishonim, they all explained it to be relating to compassion. Right? In both of the aspects. Herschel saying to wait God's mercy. Right, Herschel, you've been trained in the non-rationalist approach. I'll get to what you're saying soon. Times of the Rishonim, right, the medieval period, early medieval period, up until the 14th century. So they all explain it in terms of compassion. The negative prohibition, do not take mother and young, is about compassion, because, you know, killing two generations of animal life, giving no possibility of the mother laying more eggs, having more young, it is cruel. And the positive mitzvah also is compassion. You send away the mother bird. Why? Because for her to see you taking away the young causes a lot of distress for her. When she comes, right? And that's true. That's how it is with birds. Right? For a mother bird to see you going through the nest and taking the young causes immense emotional distress. But when you send her away, I mean, obviously she doesn't like being away either, but it doesn't cause as much sorrow for her to be just driven away from the nest. When she comes back and sees that they're gone, so she starts laying new eggs. She doesn't feel that same level of distress as when she actually witnesses you taking her young. Right? So it's not just, you know, a rationalist such as Rambam who explained it this way. No, it was across the board they explained it this way. Rashbam, Chizkuni, they talk about it being cruel and greedy to take the mother and young. Ramban, Ralbag, Rabbeinu Bachi ben Asher, they speak about how taking both mother and young is conceptually like driving the species to extermination, because you don't care about the perpetuation of the bird. Right? And then Rambam mentions the idea about, you know, compassion for the mother, and that's why she sent her away, so she shouldn't have to take the young. This was all the approach. Now, you do have a Mishnah. The Mishnah says, paste it on the screen here. If someone says, if someone's davening, someone's praying, and they say, "Your mercy extends upon the nest of birds," we silence him. And on which the Gemara, discussing that, says as follows. One of the reasons given in the Gemara for this is that because he's making the attributes of the Holy One into mercy, whereas they are nothing other than decrees. So this might be seen as the Gemara, you know, going against the rationalist view. But in fact, all the Rishonim said, you know, that we're not going to let this Gemara, there's no way this Gemara could be stopping us from taking a rationalist approach. So they had a variety of ways of doing away with it. You know, Rambam just said, well, we don't hold that like that view in the Gemara. That's the view in the Gemara which says that the mitzvot are all decrees we can't understand, but we hold otherwise. We hold we can understand the mitzvot. Ramban and others, they reinterpreted that Gemara. They said that when the Gemara says that the problem is, when the Gemara explained this as being the problem, the person saying that, you know, have mercy on me like you have mercy upon the birds, right? And it says that the person's not allowed to say such a thing. The problem with it is that it's not as though the mitzvah is because God has mercy on the birds. The reason for the mitzvah is because God wants us to have mercy on the birds. Right? The mitzvahs are for our benefit, are to train us in compassion. And the problem is with this prayer, as it's formulated in the Gemara, is that it's saying that, you know, that the reason for the mitzvah is because God has compassion on the birds. Right? So Rambam and others said, no, that's why it's wrong, because it's not God having compassion on the birds. It's God wanting us to have compassion on the birds. So again, they made, even though you have this Gemara which looks like it's going against the rationalist view, but they reinterpreted it to make it compatible with the rationalist view. Because the Rishonim were convinced that it has to be a rationalist thing. Now Herschel is saying, why take them in the first place? Simple. You want to eat. You're allowed to eat in his source of food. So you're allowed to take food to eat. Okay. So, so the mitzvah is that when you're taking, is that you're not allowed to take the mother, right? You're not allowed to take advantage of the fact that she's sticking around her eggs. You've got to let her go, let her lay some more eggs, and you have to send her away before you take the eggs so that she shouldn't suffer the distress of seeing it. Okay, so this is how the Rishonim viewed the mitzvah as being about compassion. Now, what's interesting is that starting with the Zohar, totally different view arises as to why you're doing as to the reason for the mitzvah, and it's as follows. I'm going to paste in the screen. Okay, here's what the Zohar says. There is an angel appointed over the birds, and when Israel performs this commandment, and the mother departs weeping and her children crying, he suffers for his birds. And he asks God, does it not say that his compassion is on all his works? Why did you decree on that bird to be exiled from her nest? And what does the Holy One do? He gathers all of his other angels and says to them, this angel is concerned for the welfare of a bird and is complaining of its suffering. Is there none amongst you who will seek merit for my children Israel, and for the Shekhinah which is in exile, and whose nest in Jerusalem has been destroyed, and whose children are in exile under the hand of harsh masters? Is there no one who seeks compassion for them and will attribute merit to them? Then the Holy One issues a command and says, for my sake I shall act, and I shall act for my sake. And compassion is thereby aroused upon the Shekhinah and the children in exile. What Herschel was referring to earlier, awaking God's mercy. So according to the way the Zohar explains it, the mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah about compassion, it's a mitzvah about cruelty. In other words, the point of the mitzvah is not being kind to the bird, it's being cruel to the bird. Because as a result of the mother bird suffering the distress, and the focus here is that when you're sending her away, she's going to be distressed. As a result of that, then the angel of the birds complains, and in return God says, well, why is the angel of the birds complaining, and no one's complaining about the suffering of the Jewish people and of the Shekhinah, and as a result he decides to have mercy upon the Jewish people. Right, so it's a completely different view of the mitzvah. But the mitzvah is not about being compassionate to the bird. The mitzvah is about being cruel to the bird. Right? 180 degrees opposed to the rationalist approach. Now, what's particularly interesting in this case... So there's a few interesting points to note here. Earlier we mentioned about how the rationalist approach is that, you know, the mitzvahs are to further... you know, intellectual, moral goals for individual and society. Right? So the rationalist approach is that the mitzvah is one of compassion, training us in compassion. The mystical approach is that the mitzvah is to perform a mechanistic manipulation of spiritual forces. Right? That's the idea, that by causing distress to the mother bird, you manipulate, right? You engineer a whole process amongst the angels. The bird's angel complains, and then God says, why is he the only one who's complaining? And then that results in God deciding to be compassionate to us. Okay? And so the rationalist approach is that the mitzvah is to act upon our intellect, on the shama, right, to make us more compassionate. And the mystical approach is that the mitzvah serves to manipulate things in the spiritual world. What's particularly interesting about this case is that there's a radical halachic ramification here. There's a very extreme halachic ramification, which is as follows. If the mitzvah of Shiloh HaKein is all about compassion, then what do you do if you come across a bird's nest and you don't want the eggs? Yeah, you don't want the mother bird, you don't want the eggs. So what do? You guys say? What do? Nothing. Right? You don't do anything. Because, of course, you know, the most compassionate thing of all is to just leave them alone. Right, the mitzvah is that, you know, if you want to take the eggs, which, you know, in ancient times certainly most people would want to. Right? In ancient times when food was not as plentiful as it is today, so, you know, you're walking along, you come across a bird's nest, so, you know, it's a free meal. Who would turn down a free meal? So, you know, most people would certainly want the eggs. And the mitzvah is that, you know, that even though you'd want to take the eggs and the mother bird, you're not allowed to take the mother bird, and you have to take the eggs in a humane way, sending the mother bird away first. But if you don't want to take the eggs at all, then fine. There's no reason to take the eggs. Certainly the most compassionate thing to do is to leave it alone. So, you know, the corollary of the rationalist approach is that if you don't want the eggs, you don't do anything. But with the mystical approach, where the whole idea of the mitzvah is setting into motion this whole chain of events, then it's a good idea to do it whether you want the eggs or not. Right? And this finds its expression in halachic sources, that that even though normally, you know, halacha and drush are normally kept separate. And certainly Kabbalah, it's normally kept separate. That normally in a halachic issue, poskim evaluate halachic issues regardless of any, you know, hashkafic, you know, philosophical perspectives. But here's a case where it's kind of inevitable that the two are going to end up being combined, because it's a whole different perspective on what the mitzvah is about. I'm not sure what you're writing here in this comment. That's what the mitzvah is all about. So you'll find poskim discussing the mitzvah and saying that because of what the Zohar says, that therefore the understanding of the mitzvah is that even if you don't want the eggs, either it's a good idea to take the eggs anyway, or it's even, you know, obligatory to take the eggs anyway. But certainly, even those who say it's not obligatory, they all say, you know, it's a lovely good idea to do so. And the result of it is, you get books like this. Okay, so there's a beautiful book in Shiloh HaKein here. And, you know, it has all these pictures of great rabbis doing the mitzvah of Shiloh HaKein. Now, obviously, they did not want the eggs, and you know, according to many halachic authorities, you you don't even do anything with the eggs after you eat it. You just send the mother bird away, and that's it. The point isn't even, you don't even need to have to take the eggs. The point is just that she should be distressed. The mother bird should be distressed in order to send this whole mystical approach into motion. According to the rationalist approach, that would be absurd. Right, that would be, according to the rationalist approach, that's completely undermining what the mitzvah is all about. The mitzvah is all about compassion. Why just be gratuitously cruel to the mother bird? So, you know, you see how radical the difference is. And, you know, this gets to the point where, you know, again, so the Torah promises a mitzvah for Shiloh, various rewards for Shiloh HaKein. So what's all about these rewards? So the rationalist approach is that the reward is that, you know, if you put aside your physical desires for a schnitzel and an omelet, and you moderate them out of compassion, so that's the reward. Whereas the mystical approach is, no, the reward is for making the bird suffer. The end result of this is that you have a situation where people are actively seeking out to perform the mitzvah. And in Brooklyn, there are flyers advertising that for the special price of just $600, you can perform the mitzvah of Shiloh HaKein. And this is how some people make a living. They stake out bird's nests, and they found one, they put up a flyer, and they arrange people to come and do Shiloh HaKein for all the segulas and so on involved, and $600 you can do this wonderful mitzvah. And there are people who just do it, you know, again and again and again and again and again. The idea of reaping the segula rewards from it. So this is, you know, I think this is the starkest example of just how far apart the rationalist and the mystical approach is. That you have a mitzvah which, for the rationalist approach, is entirely based on compassion, and if you don't want the eggs, you wouldn't do it. And you have the mystical approach, which is that it's based on cruelty, and therefore it's something that's a great idea to do, even if you don't want the eggs, even if you're not going to do anything with them. Chesky says that $600 a pop, it's a one-time deal. Well, some people are really willing to put themselves out financially because they believe that, you know, doing it more and more, you know, if they're unfortunately childless, right, they believe it's a school to have children, and therefore they keep doing it again and again. But, you know, even though in general I don't see the mystical approach as being necessarily harmful, this is one case where it can be. And I don't mean just for the bird. Psaki says the thing is a misunderstanding on people's part. Not sure if we blame that. Now, in terms of it being a misunderstanding of what? I don't think it's a misunderstanding of the Zohar. It's what's interesting is that these contemporary books in Shiloh HaKein, you know, traditionalists have a very hard time with the idea that there are radical differences of thought within Judaism. Right? So they always try and make sure that everyone's really saying the same thing. So they have these very creative attempts to reinterpret the Rishonim in order to make it all, you know, meld together with the mystical approach. But you end up, you know, tying yourself into intellectual pretzel. Stanley says that his rabbi ridiculed the Shiloh HaKein flyer, and he'd like to think that's a majority opinion. Well, we've got a charge sheet $600. Maybe that a lot of people ridicule that, but the idea that it's a wonderful mitzvah that everyone should perform, lots of people are into that. Look, this book is a popular book. You see many great rabbis who performed it, right? Very many of them. I get calls all the time from people saying that, you know, they've got a nest and they want to do Shiloh HaKein, and how do they go about doing it? And I'm like, well, you know, according to most of the Rishonim, if you don't want the eggs, you shouldn't do it. And they're like, yeah, but how do I do it? Right, they're just not interested to hear the idea that you shouldn't want it. Right, Yosef says, why does it supersede Tzav Aleichem? Because Tzav Aleichem is Hutul Tzorach, right? You're allowed to be cruel to animals if you're performing a need. And like, you know, Hester Azazel, right? So it's performing a need, you're allowed to do it. So this, they hold, is performing a need. But the reason why it's, you know, so if you hold the mystical, no, look, if you hold that the Zohar is, you know, Shin Ben Yochai's revelations about what goes on in the upper world, then the approach makes perfect sense, right? If this is really, if you hold that the Zohar tells us that this is really what's happening up above, then sure, why not do it? And compassion for the Jewish people is a good thing. Okay. So that's why Shiloh HaKein is a very stark example of all this. Okay, so we've been discussing lots of examples now. I think you've got an insight into the radical differences between rationalism and mysticism. If you want to have a really good further insight into it, there's a book I very much recommend called, I'll type it into the chat box here, Maimonides, confrontation with mysticism by Menachem Kellner, University of Haifa. Fantastic book, absolutely fascinating. The only great drawback is that it costs at least $50. $50 well spent. You can get it on Amazon, I believe, Jewish bookstores. A fascinating book, and he really shows in many other ways the radical differences between rationalist and non-rationalist schools of thought. Okay. So, why has rationalism gone on the decline so much? You know, it's gone on the decline so much that, I think I mentioned this last time, that the non-rationalists now, they don't even believe that there ever was a rationalist school of thought. Right? They don't even acknowledge that there was ever anything different. You know, in the supreme book against rationalism that came out recently, Chaim Ben-Munasam, and a critique of it on our website, one of the Haskamas to the book said about how, you know, people nowadays claiming that there's such a thing as different Masorahs. He's talking about me. And of course, there's no such thing as a different Masorah. This is the only Masorah. Right? So there was a radical decline. So why was there such a drastic decline in rationalism? So one reason is Zohar, right? The rise in popularity of the Zohar. That was definitely probably the major thing. Another aspect was... Right, Herschel, you wrote Full of Lies, One-Sided. What are you talking about? Talking about that, Herschel, no specify. Anyway, so one reason is the rise of the Zohar. Another reason is, oh, you're talking about that book, Chaim Ben-Munasam. Yeah. So another reason is the reaction to the Haskalah. Right, the modernity in general. Right, the more that the gates of exile, you know, the more that the gates of the ghetto opened up, and there was a threat. There was a threat to a lot of treasured beliefs and principles. So the more there was an immediate reaction to dig in the heels, become more and more traditionalist. That's definitely another aspect of why rationalism, you know, even after it declined with the Zohar, declined even further. That people can't even afraid to even acknowledge the possibility of a rationalist approach, because they see it as being a step towards the Haskalah, secularism, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, you know, the emancipation also led to a certain resurgence of rationalism. So for all that Rav Hirsch railed against Rambam, considered Rambam to be, you know, incorporating non-Jewish ideas into his ideology, certainly did, but, you know, Hirsch really attacked him for it. But Hirsch himself, in many ways, was a rationalist, certainly different from his more Haredi brethren. And then, you know, of course, the Torah Matter movement also was very much an expression of the resurgence of rationalism. There has been a resurgence. Now, obviously, like I said, you know, given my presentation last week and today, and given my work in general, so obviously I very strongly identify with the rationalist movement. But as I mentioned last week, my goal here is not to say that rationalism is correct and mysticism, non-rationalism, is wrong. I believe that both movements are necessary. Both are required. And there's two related reasons for that. Number one is that rationalism is a Pandora's box. It is. It's very, very dangerous. Being a rationalist in the 13th century itself was slightly dangerous. Being a rationalist in the 21st century is vastly more dangerous. I mean, you know, the topics we've been discussing are really the easy ones. What do you do when you get on to biblical scholarship, anthropology, archaeology? Those are things where taking a rationalist approach causes major problems for traditional views. Now, there can be ways of dealing with them, but basically, you know, lots of people have different ways of dealing with them. But usually, you either run into compromising your rationalism or compromising how much you're going to be accepted as being orthodox. Everyone has their own way of working it out. I've got my own way of working it out. But what usually ends up is people who have to be somewhat secretive about their beliefs, depending on who they're speaking with, and or not fully accepted as rationalist by the wider academic world. Right, so it's very, very difficult, very, very challenging. And certainly some people, you know, intellectually leave Judaism altogether. I think people who actually leave observance you know, shmuas and mitzvahs probably do so because they're not comfortable in the lifestyle. But certainly intellectually, a lot of people leave Judaism and undergo severe crises of faith because rationalism raises lots of very, very difficult, challenging questions. Right? And related to that is that the idea that the fact is that for many people, the non-rational approach, the mystical approach, makes a very powerful, attractive, motivating form of Judaism. And that is another reason why mysticism became very powerful. You know, with the oppressiveness of exile, it's very hard to be a Jew. And the mystical approach makes it a lot easier. But the rationalist approach is good for, it works well for the elite, and it works well in times when it's easy to be Jewish. But in times when it's very hard to be Jewish, and certainly for the masses, the mystical approach is much more successful. And you see it today, right? You see that the Haredi society, which by and large is the mystical, non-rationalist approach, is, you know, for all its problems, is better at motivating large numbers of people to be Moser Nefesh for Torah Mitzvahs. I think it's pretty much undeniable. Yes, it has many severe, severe, severe problems, and it's a society in great crisis at the moment, but they have certain successes which cannot be claimed by rationalist societies. So ultimately, you know, it's a case of one man's meat is another man's poison, right? There are some people, you know, people who are intellectually curious, people who are knowledgeable, people who are exposed to the modern world, for whom the rationalist approach is essential, right? And the mystical approach for them seems foolish, seems naive, obscurantist. It's something that completely turns them off from Judaism. But there's many other people who are perhaps not so intellectually curious or not so worldly, and for them the rationalist approach is very threatening. It's leads to atheism. It's a thing that they don't like it. The mystical approach is much more attractive, and it's certainly with regard to halacha, right? So, you know, being very, very makbid in halacha, which for many people is very important because their life meaning. So it's much more easy to be very passionate about it when you believe that every single nuance of what you're doing is having an untold, infinite effect in that number of unseen spiritual worlds. Now, whereas the idea that it's to work with, to change your mind and your midos, is it makes it perhaps less motivating. So, I'm not going to say that you know, I'm going to try and stamp out non-rationalist Judaism, when for so many people, for the majority of Jews, I would say even, it's such a more motivating form of Judaism. I see it as a case of being different strokes for different folks. And, you know, the question of how they can coexist is difficult, right? Because the rationalists have an unfortunate tendency to view the mystics as idiots, and the mystics have an unfortunate tendency to view the rationalists as heretics. But I think the way to attain coexistence is to the rationalists to realize, like the things I've been saying, that the mystical approach is very good for many people. It's what works for many people and motivating them to be good Jews. And for the mystics to realize that the rationalist approach does have its roots in the Rishonim. It's not some new fabrication of Slifkin or whatever, or the modern Orthodox, but it's something that does have a traditional roots, and it's something that for many people, that's what works for them. That's what's going to motivate them to be good Jews. So I think coexistence is challenging, but it should be possible. Now, Adam says, aren't there certain things in the mystical approach that seem to be borderline Avodah Zarah? Doesn't that make you feel that their approach is objectively bad? No. Because you could equally say that there are certain things in the rationalist approach that seem to be borderline heresy or complete heresy. Right? You know, each approach has its risks, has its problems. Okay. Now this leads on to the topic, I've only got 20 minutes left, this leads on to the topic of the ban on my books. Right? As everyone knows by now, 5 years ago, 3 of my books were put in Cheren. You can find all the gory details on my website, zutora.com/controversy. Spend many, many happy hours reading all the documents there. Here's the link, typing it in. And there was a lot of confusion as to what was going on, because there weren't any particular chiddushim in my books. Basically, everyone's trying to, you know, and the letter written against my books didn't really specify why they were banning them. And the issues that were mentioned were me saying that the world was billions of years old, and that Chazal were mistaken in science. Of course, I wasn't the first to say that. Many others had said it. So why were my books being banned? So all kinds of different explanations. They could say it, we cannot. It was the tone, it was the style. And, you know, a lot of people try and figure out why exactly were the books banned, including me. And to figure it out either. And it took me at least 2 years, maybe 3 years even to figure it out. And I finally figured out that this is what it all comes down to, nationalism. It wasn't just those specific ideas about saying the world is billions of years old and it's all mistaken in science. It was something more fundamental than that. It was the nationalist approach. That was what was wrong in my book. That was why every single page in my books was TRAFE. Originally, I couldn't understand it. You know, how could they were saying that every page in my books is TRAFE. How could every page be TRAFE? It's the idea that my books took a rationalist approach. So how does my book take a rationalist approach? Meaning, it's a critical academic method, meaning evaluating things. Right? Taking a statement in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, and saying, is that true? What is the evidence for it? And that's something which is anathema to traditionalists. You don't evaluate if it's true or not. Of course it's true. Now, so even in cases like, you know, there's one case where I quoted that Rashi says something that's seemingly very far-fetched, and I showed that scientifically it's possible. Right? So the people who were condemning my books were saying, you know, we're going furious about it. You want you to bring science to prove that Rashi could be true? And I'm saying, what's wrong? I'm saying that Rashi's true. But, you know, that's the idea, what they're objecting to, because the traditionalist, you don't bring science to prove Rashi, because you don't question Rashi in the first place. You know, you accept. When you study books, you accept. You accept everything that's in them. You don't like this whole approach of critical thinking, of questioning things. Right? Do that with the Gosha things, maybe. Not with our sacred texts. It was really and what was also very important is that what a lot of people could not come to terms with in the whole controversy is, how could it be that the Gedolim are wrong? Like, you have, you know, 3 dozen tremendously great Torah scholars, like people who spent decades spending, you know, 15, 18 hours a day studying Torah. How could it possibly be that these three dozen such scholars say that Slifkin is wrong, and he has the audacity to say that he's right? And, you know, initially, you can understand why people have a hard time with that. Right? How could it be that all these great Torah scholars go wrong, and little Slifkin is right? And what's going on? So the answer is rationalism, meaning that as much as they are great Torah scholars, but they have a particular worldview. Right? They're not rationalists, which means that everything they learn is through the non-rationalist lens. Right? When they learn Shiloh HaKein, it's through the lens of the Zohar. When, you know, every single topic we've said, they take the non-rationalist approach. When it comes to learning Chazal, so everything Chazal said was with Ruach HaKodesh, and any Rishonim that said otherwise, we don't follow them. We follow the Rishonim who stated that it was all Sor Hashem Livayot. Right? It's a whole different epistemology. It's like, I mean, you know, Lahavdil, right? I say Lahavdil many times here, but who's a greater authority on the Quran? You know, some Muslim cleric? Or one of us. Say, you know, the Muslim cleric, he spent, you know, thousands of hours more studying it than we have. Yeah, but does that mean he's correct about Muhammad's miracles? No, because he has a different epistemology. Right? He has a whole different approach to the whole topic. So with these kinds of things, in the controversy of my books, it's not a question of who spent more hours studying. It's a question of completely, radically different worldview. And my opponents have the non-rationalist worldview, but I'm pushing for the rationalist worldview. So that is really what the controversy is all about. And again, and that's why, you know, a few months ago I wrote an essay in defense of my opponents, which I defended the ban. Not that I think my books are heretical, but that I feel that the nationalist approach does certainly have its dangers. It's not for everyone. The non-rationalist community, the Haredi community, you know, modernity, excuse me, is a tremendous challenge. Tremendous challenge. So, modern orthodoxy says, let's grapple with it. And they have their own problems. Right? They have tremendous problems in keeping people motivated and in being intellectually consistent. And whereas the Haredi world says, let's try and block it out as much as possible. And they have their problems, because it is very hard to block it out, and they have to compromise intellectual integrity also in their own way. But they have tremendous gains also. So who am I to say that they shouldn't be allowed to block out rationalism? Yeah, they should be allowed to block out rationalism. Chesky is saying, please do not equate Haredi with a non-rationalist point of view. Look, it's a generalization, but it's a pretty good generalization. Okay? And there was how many people in the Haredi, you know, originally I did not want to say the ban as Haredi versus non-Haredi. I really did not want to portray it that way. Spend a lot of effort not to portray it that way, because there are a lot of people in the Haredi world who are on my side. But eventually, I gave up on that. I changed my mind. Because what I realized is that even though there were a lot of people in the Haredi world on my side, they were not able to publicly express that. Right? So it becomes, you know, the Haredi public line is definitely not a rationalist one. Maybe a lot of individuals in that world feel intellectually uncomfortable with that line, but certainly Haredi public policy is reflected in Haredi publications, Yated, Hamodia, even Mishpacha. It's certainly not the rationalist point of view. So I think it is a good, useful generalization. So that's why I feel that the ban in my books can be defended as a social policy. To some extent, it was intended that way also. And that's why when I was very naive, and that when I wrote my books, my early 20s, I figured that if the Rishonim say something, and we believe and respect the Rishonim, so why shouldn't I be able to set that in a book? What I didn't realize was that in a traditionalist, non-rationalist society, it doesn't make a difference if the Rishonim said something, and we could never acknowledge that, even if we could acknowledge that the Rishonim say things, which people have a hard time doing, but doesn't apply to us, they didn't mean it, it was for Kirov, whatever it is, it's not our approach, and we're not going to give it voice. We're not going to let that approach be heard, because it threatens our way of life. So, you know, when I republished my books after the ban, I did so in a way that I made it very clear who they're aimed at. So I hope that gives you an insight, and that's how I got into this whole rationalist topic, right? Because in the years I spent trying to understand what was going on with the ban, what exactly were they objecting to. Not even so if they knew exactly what they were objecting to, but I figured out that it all comes down to this issue of rationalism versus non-rationalism. And that's how you have this radical different perspective between those who banned my books and myself, and that's why talking about how they're much greater Torah scholars than me is irrelevant. Because it's just a whole different worldview. Right? There's the worldview of rationalism, which you find in Ramban and many others of the Rishonim, and there's the worldview of mysticism. And sure, there's lots of other factors too. Yosef mentions bad timing, people are nervous about the internet and so on. Yeah, there's definitely lots of other factors, but I think rationalism is the major factor. Okay, you can ask questions, type them into the box. This brings us to the end of this series of lectures. I really appreciate everyone joining me. I'm going to be in the US in February, the first 2 weeks of February. Still haven't finished filling my schedule. There's some poor planning on my part. So if you're interested in having me come to speak in your shul, community, in your school, if it's Shabbos or weeknights or whatever, send me an email, zoorabbi@zootorah.com. We'll see if we can work something out. Be in the New York area. Might be able to travel beyond that too. Don't forget my website, rationalistjudaism.com. Don't forget you can also subscribe to my mailing list. You send an email to address here. essays-subscribe@zootorah.com. So you get onto my mailing list, and a couple of times a year I send out essays about zoology, Torah science, and so on. Also info about my lecture tours, new books, and so on. These topics are also all discussed at rationalistjudaism.com. Alright, let's catch up with some of the questions here. I think I've caught up with all of them. Hey, Stanley, if you can get hold of that flyer about the $600 Shlucha Cain thing, I'd love to get a copy of it. Michael wants to know, how do we advance the standing of rationalism? Buy my books, give them out to people. Now, I am working on a book now, Rationalist Judaism. So the text that you have here in the on the screen here is basically the outline contents of the book. I've written a lot of the chapters already. So it's going to take me a while to finish it all off. That's one way to do it. A great journal to read is Hakira. Right. They have a website, hakira.org. One of the great things about Hakira is that previous issues are all put online for free. But it's certainly worth also buying a subscription so you can have the hard copy. I have an important essay coming out in the next issue of Hakiva, it's coming out in a few weeks, called They Can Say It, We Cannot, discussing the idea of beliefs, the parameters of belief, how do you define heresy, how can it be the idea that Rishonim said things that are now being classified as heretical. It's a provocative article, which I think you'd find interesting. Yosef says, what about intelligence? Are there people out there who simply aren't smart enough to rationalize it, to take a rationalist approach? Yeah, for sure. A rationalist approach is very demanding and difficult to come to terms with. Certainly more difficult to be motivated with Judaism than a rationalist approach. Right. A lot of people see the world in very black and white ideas. They can't hold the idea that if a great Torah sage could be mistaken about something in science, that he's still somebody worthy of respect. Like they have the idea that if they got something wrong in science, then they must be stupid. How could I respect them? Right? They can't even hold that idea in their heads. Now, in terms of, like I mentioned last week, it's not as though you're either a rationalist or a mystic. Most people are a combination of the two to varying degrees. The question is, are they being consistent or not? Cook is often mentioned to me as being a person who combined both rationalism and mysticism. I don't know enough about him to be able to say definitively. He probably was definitely, more of a combination than anyone else I know of. But I think there's certainly some issues where you really have to make a choice, and like Shiloh HaKein is one of them. Well, Psachia, long comment here. And your favorite arbiter of rationalist Judaism? That's good to know. Mild-mannered? Really? Okay, so Psachia made an important point. What is the opposite of rationalism? Is it mysticism or traditionalism? Psachia prefers the word traditionalist. The reason why I'm not so happy with traditionalist is because it has the connotation that rationalism is something new, whereas traditionalism is that's what's always been done. Whereas in fact the opposite is the case, right? And in terms of the Rishonim, it's rationalism that was much more prevalent. I know that traditionalism doesn't exactly mean that, but it has that connotation. That's one reason why I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. Naive, I definitely can't use the word naive because I'm trying not to be offensive here. Right, Stanley has a very important insight here. Stanley says, it's no wonder that non-rationalists refuse to discuss these issues with me because the discussion will be held on a rational basis and there's no way for them to win. Correct. In other words, it comes down to epistemology. For them, it's an argument based on authority. Once they open it to discussion, they will inevitably lose. But Amnon says, what about cases where Chazal or Shoni make mathematical mistakes? How do they deal with that? So what they say is, there's some deep meaning that we can't understand. Herschel says, who are the rationalists of Rishonim and Acharonim? Rishonim, pretty much everyone's found. Obviously, Rambam, Ralbag, but also to an extent, most of them were rationalists to a much greater degree, certainly than the Acharonim. Amongst the Acharonim, you see a big decline. There's Acharonim who are rationalists in certain aspects, like with Hirsch in certain aspects. Yitzhak Lamponti is an interesting person. In some ways he was very much non-rationalist, in some ways he was very much rationalist. It's all complicated. Sachi says, my opponents could provide me with a mystic experience and win the argument. If they could. Well, if they could, then they would. Yes, I'm not sure he's referring to the Angulator's comment. And to go back to Pesachi's comment, like said, mysticism is a pursuit of communion with God through direct experience, intuition, instinct, or insight. That's not the problem. I think mysticism is more the connotation of the Zohar, of the idea that Chazal had, people say things through Ruach HaKodesh rather than based on figuring things out. That's why I think mystical is useful. Not a perfect term for it, but the best term I can find. Stanley said, is there room for mysticism in a rationalist world? If yes, where? It depends on how you define mysticism. Is there room for faith? So like, some people, which I think it's fine. Some people will say that they want to be rationalist as much as possible, but not if it's going to endanger their Judaism, right? So they're going to say that their faith in God and Torah Sinai, for them, that's faith. Then they're taking that on faith, but then within that, they want to be as rationalist as possible. Fine, I'm not going to dictate to a person to what extent they should take it. Michael has a good question. How far back does the rationalist mystical divide go? Well, the question is, were Chazal rationalists or not? I find that question hard to answer. It's different dynamics back then. Chazal speak at very brief terminology. It's not always easy to figure out where they hold. Let's take demons, right? So Chazal believed in demons. I don't think that means they weren't rationalists. Because back then, when you have a lot of things in nature that you couldn't explain, so demons was a perfectly reasonable explanation. If someone believes in demons today, they're not a rationalist. But believing them back then doesn't necessarily mean you're not a rationalist. So I'm still trying to figure out what's going on with Chazal. Saki says, how Sinai is mysticism? No, it's not. But the rationalist doesn't deny the possibility that God can communicate with man. Why not? He's God. He can do anything. Oh, and people like comments in the chat box, such as, oh yes, that's a good point. I only see that comment a few minutes after I've said what I've said, so I don't know what you're referring to. Alright, some other good insights there. Yeah. And by the way, with demons, so Ramban was a very complicated figure. Very hard to classify Ramban as either rationalist or not. He was, elements of both. Ramban believed in demons, but for rational reasons. Right? Ramban said, how can you deny demons when there's so many people who attest... No, magic. He's on magic more. How can you deny it when there's so many people who attest to it? He said, there's eyewitness testimony. So what? That it's not scientifically explicable when you have a lot of eyewitness evidence. And it's true. If you do have a lot of good evidence, empirical evidence for something, then it should be accepted even if you can't explain it. But what we would say is that his empirical evidence for it was not sufficiently strong. Right, so Herschel says, how can I know there's not demons? I can't know. Right, and I can't know that there's no leprechauns or no Loch Ness Monster or these things either. But when you have something that, we know why, the reason why ancient people, of all sorts, not just you, the whole world believed in them, was that there were certain things that they were looking for an explanation for and they couldn't explain, so they said demons. Now we have explanations for these things, so we don't need to come on to demons. Alright, Sammy's good overview of mysticism. Alright, gonna have to leave it there for tonight. Thanks very much for joining me. It was really a pleasure to have you. Be in touch if you want to figure out something for my America trip. You might want to sign up for my essay list. And thanks very much. It was great to have you all. Write to Torah in Motion and tell them how much you enjoyed the program. Because they went to a lot of trouble and expense to arrange all this. They didn't charge participants, so please write to Torah in Motion and let them know how much you enjoyed it.